Welcome to a special message narrated by Stanley Monteith. Dr. Stan will play and comment on a rare taped interview with Carol Quigley, the mentor of President Bill Clinton and author of the book Tragedy and Hope.
Well, this evening we're going to have a special interview a little later in the evening, but we wanted to start out talking a little bit about the President's inaugural address, because I think if you listen to what President Clinton said, you're going to have an idea what lies ahead for America. And let me read to you the first few paragraphs of the inaugural address, because they have real meaning. The words have meaning, as Rush Limbaugh says. And he starts out with this remark: "My fellow citizens, today we celebrate the mystery of American renewal. This ceremony is held in the depths of winter, but by the words we speak and the faces that we show the world, we force the spring, a spring reborn in the world's oldest democracy that brings forth the vision and courage to reinvent America." Now, if you listen to what he's saying, he's referring to America as the world's oldest democracy. Is it that Bill Clinton doesn't know that America is a republic and not a democracy? Or is it that he doesn't want the American people to know that America is a republic and not a democracy? After all, philosophers writing at the time when America was being created as a republic, as a republican form of government, said that democracies are only a temporary form of government. They only last until such time as people decide and find that they can vote themselves into the public treasury. That had been known from the days of ancient Greece. Plato wrote about it in The Republic. He said, democracy doesn't work. That's why the founding fathers of America said, we don't want a democracy in America. Now, for those of you who are students or who are interested in checking out what we're going to say, I'd suggest that you get the 10th of the Federalist Papers. You know, I'd studied American history and American government for 25 years, just as an amateur historian, until somebody told me to read the 10th of the Federalist Papers, one written by James Madison, where he talked about democracy. What did Madison say, the man who actually was instrumental in creating the Constitution? Why, James Madison said this: democracies are air spectacles of turmoil and contention. Democracies are air incompatible with personal liberty and private property, and are usually as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. That was the feeling of the men who created America. And yet, Bill Clinton, our new president, either doesn't know or doesn't want you to know that America is a republic and not a democracy, a nation of law written on laws that are permanent and can only be changed by amending the Constitution. That's the difference between a democracy and a republic. In a republican form of government, you have a nation of law, you have division of power so that the legislation is done by the legislature and it is overlooked by the courts to make sure that it doesn't violate the law of the land, and the law of the land is the Constitution of the United States, and you can tell what the Constitution says by reading the meaning of the founding fathers of the nation. And that was the Federalist Papers, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence. Now, that's what the courts were supposed to do, was to interpret the law, not to make law, not to be political activists, not to say that the law was whatever judges said it was, because when you do that, you undermine the whole concept of a society. After all, I don't know how many of you remember seeing that wonderful film on Nuremberg. I think it was entitled Nuremberg, and it had Spencer Tracy and Burt Lancaster in it, but it was the story of the judges in Germany who violated the law because they wanted the German experiment in society to work. And it really dealt with the judges who made the decisions to sterilize people with mental defects and to allow them to be taken off to the gas chambers. And the chief German judge was played by Burt Lancaster. And the whole story was the story of how the judges compromised their position. And in the end of the movie, why Burt Lancaster, the chief German judge, has been condemned to jail, and he asked to see the American judge, who was played by Spencer Tracy. And the German judge says, I have the greatest respect for you as a jurist, speaking to the American judge, but I want you to understand, you must understand why we did what we did. We weren't bad people. We just wanted the new Reich, the Third Reich, to be successful. We wanted to make a better society, and to do that, why, we had to modify the rules as they were. We had to sacrifice certain people for the common good. It was necessary to do evil to accomplish good. And Spencer Tracy said, well, I can't understand that. You have no justification because you've betrayed the law. You've betrayed the concepts of justice. Well, that's what happens when judges begin passing laws. But we had a nation with a division of power. We had a nation which was not a democracy. That's why we had the indirect election of senators, not by the people, but by the various state legislatures. That's why we have the Electoral College, so that the people do not elect the president. The electors elect the president. The only people we were supposed to elect were the congressmen, and they were to be our representatives. And you can see how well that system works today with the degree of control over the media, so that the people never know how their congressman has voted. And the year that I ran for Congress, 98.6% of all congressional incumbents were reelected. So we have evolved from the Republican concept, a nation of law under the Constitution, into the Democratic concept, which Bill Clinton envisions. Let me read to you again his opening statement. My fellow citizens, today we celebrate the mystery of American renewal. This ceremony is held in the depth of winter, but by the words we speak and the faces we show the world, we force the spring. A spring reborn in the world's oldest democracy that brings forth the vision and courage to reinvent America. Reinvent America? What's wrong with the old America, the America that I grew up in 50 years ago, 60 years ago? America that believed in God and believed in traditional values and believed in the family and believed in hard work and believed that if you worked hard, you could get ahead. Why, of course, we've changed from that. Now people are entitled, first of all, to charity and then to welfare. And now we call it entitlements. People are entitled to the government taking care of them from the cradle to the grave. And we have government providing AFDC for children. We have the government regulating children. We have social workers who can come into the homes and take the children away from their parents. We accept that it is the responsibility of the federal government to provide for the people from the cradle to the grave, from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. And we have accepted the basic Marxist concept. That's the reason we're in so much trouble today. People don't understand that we have moved from a free society into a partially Marxist or socialist society. And people do not understand where we're headed. Most Americans have never been allowed to know what George Bernard Shaw said in his classic book, An Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism and Capitalism, or perhaps it's Capitalism and Socialism, it's one of the two. And in the last page of the book, in the appendix, he says this, when I say socialism, I mean a system of equality or nothing. You will be forcibly fed and housed and clothed, whether you liked it or not, and if you're found unworthy of all of our efforts, it may be necessary to put you to death in a kindly manner, of course, but while you're allowed to live, you will live well. That is the philosophy of the socialists. That's the philosophy of George Bernard Shaw, who is the ideal of the socialists who are working at every level of our government today to bring about a welfare state. And the problem with America is not that we need to reinvent it. We need to turn back to America's traditional concepts. Now, when Mr. Clinton, President Clinton, begins talking about where he is going with our society, he's talking about the necessity for a national industrial policy to get the economy moving, to coordinate our great corporations. A national industrial policy is what they had with state capitalism in Benito Mussolini's Italy, and what they had with state capitalism in Hitler's Germany. In other words, the government working in concert with the great capitalists to control industry, to provide jobs. But a government that can control industry and provide jobs must be able to control the populace. And that's why the big move is on towards gun control in America. That's why the move is going to be towards ever-increased taxation and regulation, towards changing our money, towards changing us towards a cashless society. And that is the timely vision of this new world that we seem to be moving into under our new leadership. Well, this evening I have a I have a special tape that I'm going to play for you, and I hope it turns out all right. I haven't had a chance to listen to it. But I've been promising you that we would sometime very soon have an opportunity to listen to the man who was the mentor of the new president of the United States. Now, you all know Bill Clinton's history. Born I believe it was Arkansas, and eventually he went to Georgetown University. This is where he took his college training, and there he was under the tutelage of a man named Carroll Quigley. And Carroll Quigley was a professor of history. He was an economist. He was into anthropology. He was a brilliant individual, probably, you know, one of the great minds of our time, a dedicated liberal. But he stumbled onto a series of secret societies. He ran into a man named Zimmern. And Zimmern, I guess it was somewhere in the 30s, told him that he had been part of a secret society in England. And that before the First World War, they had mobilized England to become an ally with France and to go to war with Germany. And immediately after the First World War, they turned on France and became an ally of Germany, and they were working to build up Adolf Hitler. And this so intrigued Professor Quigley that Professor Quigley spent 30 years of his life researching the secret societies to understand the forces behind government, the forces really behind those people who controlled government, both in our nation, in England, and throughout the world. And so he wrote a series of books. And you hear him talking about those books this evening. The first book, The Anglo-American Establishment, what he ran into when he actually tried to get that book published. We're going to give you an insight into the man who was named by the President of the United States, Bill Clinton, as the man who formed his attitude, attitude towards the world in his acceptance speech. When he was nominated by the Democratic Party to become the President of the United States, Bill Clinton said, "There are two people who have molded my outlook on the world. One was John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and the other was my professor at Georgetown University, Carroll Quigley." Well, tonight we're going to play a tape of an interview with Carroll Quigley made somewhere probably in the early 1970s, not too long before his death. The tape has never been played on any radio station. To my knowledge, in America today, I don't know anybody else who has ever heard this other than the few people that I've given copies to. I went to Georgetown University in about 1980 because Carroll Quigley was one of those people who really intrigued me. I'd never heard of Bill Clinton at the time, but Carroll Quigley was a clue to understanding the secret societies working behind the scenes. And as I went through his papers, it was quite obvious nobody had been ever through them before. They were in a couple of great big cardboard boxes, totally unorganized. And here was a man who obviously in his entire life had been very, very organized. But Carroll Quigley's papers were there, mismatched. I organized them. And at the bottom of one of the boxes, I came across this tape with his wife's permission. I actually purchased the tape from her with the thought of using it in a motion picture we were making at the time. In fact, I brought a film crew to Washington, D.C., specifically to interview Mrs. Quigley so she would tell you some of the things that are on this tape. And after going to Washington, D.C. with a 9-man film crew, it, believe me, at a tremendous personal expense, and we at that time did interview General Albert Wedemeyer and several other people. But when I contacted Mrs. Quigley, she was just a little withdrawn, and she said, "Well, Doctor, I'm terribly sorry. I know I told you I would give you a personal interview, but I have been advised not to allow you to interview me. You see, I'm a writer, and my publisher is Macmillan." Now, that may not mean much to the listeners today, but after you heard the tape, perhaps you'll understand why Mrs. Quigley was frankly afraid to talk to me or to have a filmed interview to give the background behind the fact that Macmillan Publishing House in America had specifically suppressed, censored, actually destroyed the plates to Professor Quigley's book so it couldn't be reprinted, so people would not know who was really working behind the scenes to control our society.
So, well, then you remember he was summoned before a congressional committee, flatly refused to answer any questions, took the case, I believe, to the Supreme Court, but I may be wrong, and won his case.
This is the son or the father?
This is the son, Corliss Lamont.
Now, this is Professor Quigley, so that you'll know who we're talking, and he's talking to a reporter from the Washington Post.
Yes, now they ascribed it to this. These are communist sympathizers. They're for world domination. They are anti-capitalist. They want to destroy America, and, well, a number of other things, which to me, I can't see this.
And Dr. Carol Quigley knows all about it and has told the world.
Yes, and he proves everything that we've said, but then they constantly misquote me to this effect, that they financed the Bolsheviks. I can see no evidence from anything I've ever seen that there was any financing of the Bolsheviks by the group I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. You see, to give you one example of what he says in here, and they'll all say this, Milner did go to Moscow in 1917, and I have the exact dates that he was there from his diaries and everything.
I think you make that point in here.
Oh, you have that. Oh, right. Then you know that.
Now, the professor is talking about his book, so you know the background. Milner was one of the disciples of Cecil Rhodes, who created the secret societies.
I haven't had a chance, and nobody will finance me. I can't get a nickel. I have to save my own money. Do you see?
The Bircher should finance you.
They don't have any money, much, I don't think. You know, he's living off the peanuts, I think. So, if I wanted to check this, but as I understand it, he came back and told the cabinet, don't have to worry about the Eastern Front. The Russians are going to go on fighting. And within a month, they had the Kerensky Rebellion.
Right.
Now, they didn't get the Bolshevik revolution until October. Mm-hmm. So he was there in February. Kerensky is March. Lenin is October. What these people say is that when he was there, he gave $1 million to the Bolsheviks, and the Bolsheviks took over within a month. You see?
Well, now, when did you first become aware that you had been quoted in these books? Did someone get a fan letter?
Wrote to me and said this.
What did they say? Did they say things like, thank you for exposing? Were you a reluctant hero?
No, they said, do you know about this? They were usually ex-students. Now, this one I believe I got when someone in New Hampshire, where my brother is a voter, he got one, and jokingly he said, I used to be known as Dr. Quigley, the chairman of the school committee of this town that he lives in, Hudson, New Hampshire, and all of this, the man who built the local high school, which he did, you see, and so forth. And he says, now I'm known as Carol Quigley's brother. Of course, he's kidding.
Sure.
But he sent me it. And so I found it. Then,
what was your reaction?
I was mad as hell. Yeah. Just like I was mad at the other thing, because these people are not only misrepresenting me, they're making me out to be, I think, an idiot. They're saying I said all kind of things I didn't say.
I think they're making you out to be a hero. I mean, not...
Well,
it
varies. Originally, the John Birch periodical had me as a great guy for revealing this, but then they became absolutely sour, and they're now denouncing me. I'm a member of the establishment, and
You're repudiating it?
I don't know.
You don't know what?
I don't know, really. I'm baffled. I'm baffled by the whole thing. I don't know why Macmillan acted the way it did. I don't know why I can think these guys...
What he's basically talking about is the fact that his book was quoted by many of the right-wing organizations in America, and he's very unhappy that they said that he said that these people were financing Bolshevism.
From the University of Nevada, I believe it was, in Reno, I think. And he was very angry over what was going on there over this.
Now, this is in the 71?
No, this would be 73.
73, so it came to your attention.
This came in the election of 72.
72.
The
okay.
spring of 72.
Okay, fine. That was right after it came out.
Yeah, I think.
Okay. And then in 73, somebody called you.
In 73, somebody called me. Now, I can give you the exact dates on this if I can get to the papers, but I don't have them anyway. And he wanted me to do something to stop the influence that this book was having in Nevada, particularly as promoting anti-Semitism. because there's a group of people who are using this book, and they're total nuts. I get letters from them all the time. I can show you some of them if you want. Complete nuts. Who claim that this is a Jewish conspiracy, that is part of the same thing as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which we now know is a Tsarist Russian police forgery of 1905 or 1904, do you see? Mm-hmm. And that this is the same thing as the Illuminati. And the Illuminati were founded in 1776 by a Bavarian named, I think it's Weisskopf, or something like that. And that the Illuminati are a branch of the Masons, and that they took over the Masons, you see. And the whole thing is a nightmare.
Right.
That all secret societies is the same secret society. Now, this was established by nuts for hundreds of years. There were people who set the society in Cincinnati in the American Revolution, of which George Washington was one of the shining lights, was a branch of the Illuminati. And was a secret society, and therefore that's why the Masons built the monument in Alexandria to Washington. Not because he was the first president of the United States, because he was the Mason and the head of the Illuminati in this country, and therefore was the one of the founders of the Society of Cincinnati. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it becomes, you can't believe it. Now, these same conspirators are the Jacobins who made the French Revolution. A woman named Nesta, N-E-S-T-A, Webster, wrote that book. To refute it, my tutor, who's a Rhodes Scholar, Crane Brinton, B-R-A-N-T-O-N, wrote his doctoral dissertation called The Jacobins, in which he refutes her. Do you see?
Right.
Now, I think at the end of his life, Brinton probably came to feel that he was wrong, that there was some secret society involved in the Jacobins. Mm. And a student of his named Elizabeth Eisenstein, who's a marvelous researcher, she's now a professor at American University, under Brinton, wrote a doctoral dissertation on the founder of the Babeuf conspiracy. The Babeuf conspiracy was an conspiracy of the extreme left, which burst out in France in 1894 or so, led by a man named Babeuf, who was executed for it. But the man behind it was a descendant of Michelangelo named Buonarroti, because Michelangelo's family name was Buonarroti. Look, if you can, at Eisenstein's book, which was published by Harvard, her doctoral dissertation, which shows that Buonarroti founded many secret societies. You see, one of them was the Babeuf people, who are now being praised to the skies by all the neo-Marxists, like Marcuse and others, you see, as the great heroes, because they tried to change the French Revolution from a middle-class, bourgeois, capitalist revolution, constitutional revolution, into a communist revolution. Now, Buonarroti is also the founder of the Carbonari, of which Mazzini was the head in the 1840s, which united Italy in the 1860s. Do you see? So, as if you start with Buonarroti, which as far as I can see is 1794, I think you can trace a connection down through these various secret societies, which culminate in the Mazzini Carbonari.
Now, just let me briefly comment. What he's basically saying is there are secret societies and there are conspiracies, and these were around shortly before the turn of the century. And here's a man who ought to know. He's researched secret societies. This is the man, remember, that Bill Clinton mentioned as the man who shaped his attitude, formed his ideas about the world, along with J.F. Kennedy. And Carol Quigley, even though poo-pooing the right wing that thinks there's a conspiracy, is now telling you about Babeuf and his conspiracy, the Mazzini and the Carbonaris, and he's beginning to take you into some of the conspiracies. So let's go on now with Professor Quigley.
For example, I'll say one thing.
Okay.
Italy was able to get free from Austria because France defeated Austria. Why did France do that? Nobody can see why. It wasn't to France's interest. And yet France declared war in 1859 on Austria, and at the Battle of Magenta and Solferino, defeated, and suddenly made a peace treaty without freeing all of Italy. And the reason we're told they suddenly made the peace treaty without was because the king, the emperor, this is Napoleon III, was so sickened at the sight of the blood. Do you see? Now, why did he do this? He did this because in 1868, a Carbonaro threw a bomb at him. This Carbonaro was arrested, executed, but before he was executed, the emperor went to his cell, as I understand it, and the Carbonaro gave him the secret sign of a fellow Carbonaro, because the emperor of France, who was elected president of France in 1848, seized the throne in 51 and proclaimed a new Napoleonic empire, and was overthrown by the Germans in 71. So he was the emperor for 70, really, for 20 years, do you see? Mm-hmm. But he had been a refugee from France because he tried to make a revolt in France, I think it was 1829. Mm-hmm. And as a refugee, he joined the Carbonari secret society.
Here he's saying that a president of France is part of a secret society. And you see how this worked? And the revolutionary gave the emperor or the king of France the secret sign to show that he was part of the conspiracy. It's amazing. You're never going to hear these things any other place. And yet there are professors, there are people who've written about these. And I can give you the names of several books. In fact, one written by the man who is presently the head of the Smithsonian, a former member of the Board of the Council on Foreign Relations, who's written extensively on this aspect of the conspiracy. In other words, the Carbonari, Babeuf's conspiracy, the Jacobins. But he never tells you what the Council on Foreign Relations is all about. Incidentally, Bill Clinton is part of the council. He's a member of the Bilderbergers and the Trilateralists. So Bill understands how it all worked. He got this from his professor, who is deeply steeped in the tradition of secret societies. So on with Professor Quigley.
The mysterious figure, do you see? Mm-hmm. So what I'm summing up is this. I do think that there was probably a continuous sequence of secret societies from Buonarroti, Babeuf conspiracy, which is 1894-95, through the Carbonari unification of Italy, which would be 1861. I cannot see anything since then. It may exist. I haven't really studied it. But I cannot see any connection between the Masons and the Illuminati, founded in Bavaria in 1776. And I can't see any connection between them and Buonarroti. Well, now, but that's what these people are saying. It's all one.
Right.
And some of them say it goes back to Noah building the ark.
One thing that it seems to me this conspiracy theory of history is appealing because
it's so simple.
It explains everything that is unexplainable.
What's going wrong?
And if you raise one point that doesn't fit, they say, "Ah, see how clever the conspiracy is."
Yes. Now,
that
I want to show you something. This is what they start. They start by showing you a $1 bill, mm-hmm. and they say, "Why is there a pyramid with an eye over it?" Do you see?
Mm-hmm.
This is the symbol of the secret society. Now, if you ask people, the secret society, according to them, there's only one, you see.
That's right.
Now,
the secret society that's gone through generations. Through
yes, yes. Now, if you ask the United States government why it is there, mm-hmm. they have great difficulty explaining, and they mostly come up with it's the Masons, Masonic symbol. But then you say, why should the Masonic symbol be on the American dollar bill? Mm-hmm. And they have no explanation. So there is something. If you look at this monument in Alexandria mm-hmm. to Washington, it is the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
You see, now there's no, the eye over it is the light.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Mm-hmm.
So I could go further into this, but won't have to, because this symbol is at least 6,000 years old. And I can give you the history of 4,000 BC. It has nothing to do with the Masons.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble is that every Mason knows that that's a Masonic symbol, and the reason it's on the back of the bell, it was because put on the back of the Great Seal of the United States back in about 1790, something of that sort. It was put onto the dollar bill under the direction of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was a 33rd degree Mason. And that's why it's on the back of the dollar bill, because FDR put it there, symbolizing the Masonic control and domination of our government and its influence at that time. So let's go on with Professor Quigley now. You see, he raises all these points, and then he says, well, there's really nothing to it, but maybe there is something to it. Notice how he poo-poos on one side and then says, well, maybe there's something to it. I mean, after all, the pyramid really doesn't mean anything. It goes back 6,000 years. But then Masonry claims to go back 6,000 years, too, to the building time of the building of the temple, in fact, to the time of ancient Babylon.
Maybe the Masons adopted it, you see. But it has nothing. But I will not go into that. That's a totally different story.
Okay, so this man from Nevada, or this person from Nevada
called me up and said they were having a hard time with the anti-Semites using this book as an argument against Wall Street, against bankers, against Jews, against communists, and everything else. And they wanted me to debate with this fellow who got in touch with me, who was a professor at the university.
Who believed
it? No, he doesn't believe it. He was trying to get rid of it. The same way the fellow who called me from Brigham Young was trying to stop this hysteria, which was sweeping that mountain area, apparently.
Right.
And so they said, would you debate Gary Allen and Larry Abram? And I said, well, I'd rather not. Frankly, he says, well, we need your help. And I says, well, are they both going to be debating me? And he says, no, there's a Dr. So-and-so here.
Larry Abram puts out a newsletter today called The Insider Report, and he and Gary Allen had written a book called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. Had 7 million copies printed, distributed all over America. An interesting study in thought control today is to try to find a copy in any of the used bookstores. And most of them all have paperback books. Try to get a copy of Gary Allen's None Dare Call It Conspiracy, probably the most widely circulated book in America during the 1960 period. 7 million copies printed. So I think that was the figure that was put out at the time. And yet that book has literally disappeared. But Gary Allen has since died. Larry Abraham, we'll have him on the program here some night, or Larry Abram. Good patriot. He's been around for a long time in the battle. His newsletter, The Insider Report, really deals with the Council on Foreign Relations. But let's get back to Carol Quigley here. We are in the early 70s.
Who will debate with you, and he is, I think, a medical doctor. I'm not certain of that, but he was Jewish. And what he was interested in was the anti-Semitism part
of it. He's going to debate on your team, on your side.
On my side. Right. And they said it's going to be absolutely the strictest thing. We'll be on the air for an hour. We'll be hooked up on telephone through the country. I will be the coordinator, said this fellow, of this, and it'll be rigorous. You must stay on the subject or I will stop you. There must be no personality attacks or I will stop you. You can each talk for 10 minutes, I think it is, or 5 minutes it could have been. And then when each of the four has talked, I think it was for 10 minutes, then each will have the right to have a five-minute rebuttal or something, you see. Mm-hmm. Now, in the course of it, I soon discovered that Gary Allen didn't know up from down.
Mm-hmm.
But Larry Abram was immensely well-informed. He knew all about corporation finance and bankers and who were their partners. He's tremendous, I think.
How did you find out talking to people?
I found out in the debate.
Oh, okay, that's what I was going to ask. You did go to the debate?
Yeah, Larry Allen simply repeated everything that was in here.
Right.
When I put in my rebuttal and said these various things, he then started pulling information at me. Some of it I had never heard of. Now, I don't know everything. And the new book that's out now, published by the Buckley, I guess it's the Bill Buckley Press, Arlington House, I suppose it's Bill Buckley, I'm not sure of that, called The Bolsheviks and Wall Street. Oh, we got to go to lunch. The Bolsheviks and Wall Street has lots of things in there that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
I can stop this.
Yeah, well, I told you that. You want to put down there?
Yeah.
I generally would think that any conspiracy theory of history is nonsense, for the simple reason that most of the conspiracies that we know about seem to me to be the conspiracies of losers,
people who have been defeated on the platforms, let's say, the historical platform of the public happenings. The Ku Klux Klan was the... their arguments and their point of view had been destroyed and defeated in the Civil War. Well, because they're not prepared to accept that, they form a conspiracy, you see, to fight against it in an underground way. And those people who could fight up in the open do so. Those who can't go underground. It seems to me this is essentially what conspiracy, the Palestinian Liberation Army, would be a similar thing. You see, I think that on the whole they're pretty well a group that you know, has not got really very much, and so they have to be terrorists. And
just, well, if I can play the devil's advocate, I think talking about the international banking conspiracy, they have not lost out. They simply don't want any attention. They don't want to draw the ire of the people.
An argument there that if people are doing something that's very successful, they would frequently appear that they would hope that other people won't know what they're doing, like trade secrets. Coca-Cola, we're not supposed to know what is the secret formula that makes that such an attractive drink. So in a sense, the bankers, I think there's not the slightest doubt. In fact, I do say this in my book. They tried to make banking into a mystery.
Right.
They tried to make the gold standard into something which is very, very complicated and isn't. It's really quite simple once you diagram it, like I do, and put it on the blackboard. So we're dealing with two different things here, however. I don't think this is a conspiracy. This is just secrecy.
Because something secret doesn't mean it's a conspiracy.
It doesn't mean it's a conspiracy. There's lots of things. We have trade secrets. I mean... I can see where a labor union might be violently object to you knowing what the salary of their leaders are. I never knew what John L. Lewis's salary was in the United Mine Workers, and if I did, I'd probably been damn angry.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I want you to think about what you just heard and what Professor Quigley is basically saying.
Even before.
What Professor Quigley is basically saying is that... The bankers don't want us to know what they're doing. They don't want us to understand banking, and they don't want us to understand the gold standard. It's secret. Well, you may think that it's not a conspiracy. Maybe you don't want to call it a conspiracy. The thing is that there is an organized effort to confuse us about banking, to confuse us about gold, to confuse us about the fact that our money really is worthless, is only a fiat money system. And if you look at the dollars that you have, that... it says in the right lower left corner, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, period. It used to say it's redeemable and lawful money at any branch of the United States Treasury, but it doesn't say that anymore. In other words, they've kept it a secret. Professor Quigley understands that it's a secret that they don't want you to know. The international bankers have a secret, and that's what he lays out in his book, and that's why his book is so important. His book, his opus, his life work, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And now, back to Carol Quigley.
Well, he's been damn angry. You see, and yet, and that's a secret, but I don't think that is what we mean by a conspiracy.
Right.
Now, on the other hand, there certainly in history have been conspiracies. There's no doubt about this.
Really?
They're damn difficult to establish. You know, we spent a long, long time trying to find out whether there was a conspiracy regarding the assassination of President Lincoln. And they're still debating about it.
They put to death four people,
now,
don't you know that?
Debating about Jack Kennedy being assassinated, or even Martin Luther King. Now that's out, you know, in the open again. So there must be such things as conspiracies, and I can see where a conspiracy could lead to an assassination or something like that, which is a particular episode happening. But I certainly can't accept or even give real consideration to this conspiracy theory of history, which sees a conspiracy which goes on for decades or even centuries and which is more or less worldwide, you see.
And which causes everything.
And definitely as far as it causes everything. Yes, I agree. That is nonsense, it seems to me. Because any organization, take a fraternity or anything, when the personnel change, the thing changes. If I were to go back now, I had a student went back to Princeton Graduate School to apply for admission 2 weeks ago, came back and told me what it was like. It's totally different from when I was there. Well, that's not the result of conspiracy. That's the result of the people that were there have retired or gone elsewhere, and new ones have come, and they have different attitudes and different values and so forth and so forth. And so I think that even if you did have a conspiracy going on, or let us say even some of these things like the Masons, if they are secret and if they are conspiracies, I don't know anything about them. I doubt if they are. Then it seems to me that they're bound to change in the course of time so that 40 years later, 50 years later, almost certainly they're not going to be trying to do the same things with the same methods as earlier. So I think anybody who talks about conspiracy theory of history, the burden of proof rests on them to produce decisive evidence and not simply odd parallels.
And of course, Gary Allen's book is saying that you have produced the decisive evidence.
He's applied it to a totally wrong group. I wasn't talking about everybody in Wall Street.
Right.
As a matter of fact, when he says Wall Street, he's talking about a very complex structure made up, I suppose, of hundreds of partnerships and companies and corporations. And they're not only trying to screw us, which I think they are, and trying to screw the world, I'm sure they are, but they're trying to screw each other. So when he says Wall Street, then when he finds somebody that he calls a famous Wall Street man that I never heard of, or that he's some insignificant company, or something like this, and he says, this is part of the conspiracy. I'll put it much more specific than that. Avril Harriman, Forrestal, it was Brown Brothers, was he?
Right.
Brown Brothers.
Yeah.
All right. I don't see Brown Brothers as being part of any conspiracy in which, let us say, J.P. Morgan was involved. Because I never hear of anything in which they were jointly working on any corporation or floating securities and everything. Now, these things may exist. I never saw them or found them. So if somebody says, well, here's Brown Brothers doing this, or they say, here's Jim Forrestal establishing a unified defense service by putting the Navy and the Army together and having three services under it and so forth, and he's doing that as part of a Wall Street conspiracy, to me there's at least two links missing there. First, is he doing that because he was a member of Brown Brothers? They don't demonstrate that. Secondly, is this got anything to do with anything that J.P. Morgan or anybody else wanted? And of course, Morgan was finished when he did that. So, but whoever would, and mostly it was the DuPonts took over a lot of the DuPont, a lot of Morgan stuff. And the Rockefellers took over most of it. But I don't think that... here you've got links constantly missing and assumptions which aren't true, that they're a solid group cooperating together.
How has this sort of publicity changed your life? Have you enjoyed it because it may have sparked a little debate?
No, I didn't enjoy it at all, and I'll be perfectly frank and mercenary about it. As long as I had no book to sell, what good did it do me? It blackened my reputation. Among scholarly historians are going to say, oh, that's one of those nuts.
Right-wing nut.
And they're likely to say that because I'm at a Catholic university where there's lots of right-wing nuts, you know. I would assume that Bill Buckley, who some people would regard as a right-wing nut, or this brother-in-law of his, you remember? Was much more able, I think. Much more right-wing now, isn't it? I forget. They both wrote jointly a book on Joe McCarthy, defending Joe McCarthy. You see, his name also begins with B, and I should know it, but I don't.
Brent Bissell is the name.
A lot of people say they are right wingers because they're Catholics. They're defending Joe McCarthy, probably because they're Catholics. Do you see? And so forth. And so it doesn't do me any good being a Catholic university where I'm trying to be an objective historian and say exactly what happened if I can find out. And give it the proper amount of weight. Now, this is important. In my book, which is 1,348 pages, you've got 15 pages. I haven't counted them, but it certainly isn't 20. Dealing with this particular thing, and it's the Round Table, Milner, Rhodes Trust thing. It's the Atlantic establishment. It has nothing to do with what these people are talking about at all. And they come up with... Shift and other names, and mostly their Jewish names they're coming up with, in Wall Street, whom they say gave millions of dollars to the Bolsheviks. I don't see any connection here at all.
Other than your professional reputation that you perhaps worry about or fear for because of this, how about your personal life? Does it cause you any anguish at all?
Oh, no.
You have not gotten any prank phone calls?
I get phone calls. In fact, I've even out at the farm, I get people calling from Texas, and they used to get many more. And they're always long distance, and they always can talk forever. I suppose they got oil wells paying for it or something. I don't know what it is. But I've had people call me from California and from Texas. I think I had somebody call me from Mexico City.
What do they want to talk about?
And Florida. Yeah, they want to... Well, I here's one. I had one that went on and on and on up at the farm, and I was trying to write.
Right.
On another book.
I was going to ask.
Dealing with work weapons. And that's one reason I go up there every chance I can get.
Right.
Another thing, I rarely take calls at home or I'm at home. My wife always answers the phone. If it's someone, you know, she can keep... I say that I'm out of town, even if I'm not, I suppose. But I had a fellow call me from, I think it was Texas, and he talked for about 20 minutes. And I want to get back to finish a sentence I'm typing.
Right.
And finally, I said, I'm sorry, I just can't go on talking like about this. I've got to get back to my work. He said, I got one more question. This is 2 years ago. One more question, Professor Quigley. Why is Nelson Rockefeller a communist? And I said, why don't you call him up and ask him? I said, I don't know. I said, I don't think he is a communist. But if you know he is, and you want to know why he is, call him up. Now, this is the kind of thing you get. Now, this is annoying in a way, but it doesn't interfere with my personal life in any way.
Well, let me comment briefly on what he's said. He talks about Milner and the Rhodes Trust, and basically, of course, the original impetus for the organization that he studied was Cecil Rhodes, who gained the wealth of the diamond and gold mines of South Africa to establish the Rhodes Trust and then to establish the Rhodes Scholarship so they could bring young men from all over the world to Oxford to train them in the concept of the New World Order and indoctrinate them in the socialist concepts of Cecil Rhodes' teacher, a man named John Ruskin. And of course, John Ruskin was a disciple of Rousseau, and if you read Ruskin's work, he talks about how all of his concepts came from Rousseau and the Enlightenment and the socialist ideas of Rousseau and Voltaire. The problem is that many of the people who pick up on this material then immediately want to take it off and say, well, it's a Jewish conspiracy, which it is not. In fact, this isn't what he's talking about at all. And unfortunately, there are people who will try to throw you off the track of what's going on today and take you into anti-Semitism. Now, we're about halfway through the tape by Cecil Rhodes. I'm going to leave the lines open for just a moment or two while we... So let's go back to Professor Quigley as he begins telling us about the problems that he faced.
I got my lawyers to try and find out who is doing this. Now, I don't know exactly what he did. All I know is that the district attorney out there in Southern California apparently stopped publication of the book. And I don't know that because anybody tells me. Nobody's told me anything. Even my lawyer doesn't tell me. Maybe he doesn't know. All I know is that the book store here...
Actually, we started going the wrong way. Let's go on here.
And every time they wanted to buy some, they had to send them a check. If they wanted to buy 10 of them, they sent 10 times and so forth. Get them. And they sent an order in, and it came back scrawled on it. I can supply no more until Dr. Quigley, Professor Quigley, gives me permission. And that shouldn't be hard for you to get since he's at your university. This is scrawled across their order.
This is just recently, this year.
Oh, it's five or 6 weeks ago. Or maybe 2 months.
Right.
Sometime.
Now, when I first met you in your office, you had just gotten that letter from the Liberty Lobby guy, right? Saying, let's talk, or we...
Yes, now, I'd rather that this didn't go on to this. I don't think they would want it, because I'm not...
A-N-G-R-I-F-F yeah. Press.
Angriff Press.
In Sausalito?
Is that how they pronounce that? Yeah. I never knew that was how they pronounce it. No, this is in Hollywood. And it's box 2726.
They're publishing suppressed books, censored books. That's Angriff Press.
Well, I will check back with you as I get close to my deadline, and I'll try to, so I can say whether it is.
And it will go practically, this is Miss Veit, and this is Rudy Maxa.
How do you do?
You've heard of him. She comes, when she finishes work, she was my assistant for a number of years, and she comes to make sure I get to this class, I think.
All right.
We're all right now. We're sitting pretty right now.
I think we are, yeah.
Time-wise.
I'm going to start structuring and...
In fact, you won't be coming out until January, will you?
I can't see it now.
No. So by that time, I ought to know whether this guy's gone through or not.
Right.
Or even whether I can get any.
Right. And I'll be able to say yes.
Yeah, it is available.
We'll just go as far as we can to the wire before I write a firm paragraph.
They're talking about the fact that nobody can get his books because the plates have been destroyed.
If you put in the center of it, this holistic approach to the world's problems.
I understand that is
yeah.
you.
Yeah, this is me. And that, incidentally, in this holistic picture of what happened from 1895 to 1965, the 70 years,
income.
Is this
aberration.
This 20 pages on
right.
this...
Right. This, I mean, that's, yeah, that's exactly...
And this is the Atlantic community thing. Now, you should look up Clarence Streit, Streit. Right. He was a big noise. He wrote three books, Union Now with Great Britain, and the third one was during the war, and he wanted union with Norway, Sweden, Netherlands, and some other places, northwestern Europe too, you see. And let's look and see if he's still alive. He's still alive. And he very definitely...
Boy, by that time we were ready to take over and move them in and so forth. Now, in that group, there were 55 who already had PhDs, you see. Mm-hmm. So it was a very good group. The only one I had any trouble with had been a district attorney in Indiana and a Republican politician. And I had trouble with him over certain things. For example, the Civil War in Spain. I gave him the truth of the Civil War in Spain. I mean, this was not a communist revolt against the Catholic Church or something like this, you see, and that's what this guy was. So this is the substance of the book, Tragedy and Hope.
Did you know while you were working on this?
No. I was just trying to, you know,
keep
a day-to-day basis.
But you realize at the end of the accumulation... research and...
Well, yes, I knew a hell of a lot more about most of this than most people. Mm-hmm. Now, I then spent 20 years writing it.
From 20 years?
To 65. And put it in, do you see, in 65. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, I had written a shorter book, which 15 publishers had rejected, and I had set it aside. I wrote it the first time in the only summer I had off, which was 1942. In that whole period. I went for 20 years without any time off. No sabbaticals, no anything. From 42 to 61, when I took off and went to England and did research. And then I got another sabbatical in 71, when I again went to England on a sabbatical. And the only sabbatical time, whether I'll get it or not, I've asked for one semester of sabbatical before I retire. That simply means I get full pay for one semester. It seems to be half pay or whatever it is. I don't know what it is. I can't even look in. I don't have time to look into it. Mm-hmm. But in any case, I worked out all of these things, and my first book had been rejected by 15 publishers.
Now, I want to tell you a little bit about the first book. It's called The Anglo-American Establishment. I have an original copy from the manuscript I got back in Georgetown, but the book is available. Turned down by 15 successive publishers. Nobody wanted to touch it. Had to be published by somebody who deals with suppressed books. And it is available, and if you'd like to find out how to get it, you can write to us, Post Office Box 13, Santa Cruz 95063. But what he does, he goes into the background of Cecil Rhodes, goes into the background of this group of aristocracy in England who were intent upon taking over control of the world and how they went about creating the Boer War. One of the amazing stories, a war nobody wanted, but then it isn't anywhere near as interesting as how this same identical group created the First World War and actually controlled the British government and then brought America into a First World War, a war that neither the British people nor the American people nor the French people nor the German people nor the Russian nor the Austrians wanted. Nobody wanted the war, but the Anglo-American establishment wanted a war, and they got it, just exactly as most Americans didn't want to go to Vietnam, but this was forced upon us, as was Korea, as was our involvement in all of the wars going all the way back to the Civil War. But that's another story. But you can't understand the contemporary wars from 1898 until the present without understanding the Anglo-American establishment and 15 publishers. You just heard it. 15 publishers wouldn't touch it. Remember, 464-8295, and as soon as we are through with this tape, it'll be about 30 minutes. We'll open our lines for your comments. On with Carol Quigley.
I had written it first in the summer of 34. I then spent the summer of 42 in Princeton in Donald Stauffer's, and he died as Easton Professor of Literature at Oxford after climbing the Pyrenees, running up and down the Pyrenees. And I rewrote it in 42. Then I set that aside and wrote it a third time, just dashed it off. And that is the book, The Evolution of Civilizations. It's only 279 pages, but it's still the best thing, and there are a number of books that quote it as the best thing on why civilizations rise and fall and how they do and so on. So it's a big thing, you see. Now, this world since 1914 covers 70 years, from 1895 to 1965, and in that way, but it covers the whole world. So again, it's a pretty big thing because it goes into science and technology, as you will discover if you start reading the paperback, and economics, and as you see, I can do more in economics than economists can.
One thing that intrigues, well, just last night my wife and I was talking about you, was the title of the book, Tragedy and Hope.
And Hope, yes. Because
it's such a large title.
Yes. Now, what it means is this. I think it is absolutely tragic. It is shameful. It is sinful that Western civilization is going to go down the drain. When I wrote that book, which is less than 10 years ago, I had hope that we could save Western civilization. I am extremely skeptical now that it can be saved. I think we're just about finished. And I just threw a few things out here this morning in the class. You know, if we're going to allow a coal strike and yes, if we're going to overthrow the Portuguese government. Because as soon as all these military dictatorships are not going to last. So we get rid of a democracy because it wants to be a little liberal. Mm-hmm. And we put in a military dictatorship, which then collapses, and what happens? The communists come in. Mm-hmm. This is what happened in Portuguese. Salazar was there since 1927. You see? Mm-hmm. All right, now they suddenly try to establish some kind of a non-military dictatorship. He wasn't the military, he was a college professor, but he was supported by the reactionary groups, and now they want to do something about that, and the same thing could happen in Greece. They're now going to probably, in Greece, try these generals who established the military dictatorship because we got them to do it, you see. And this gives the communists, and it could well be. Now, this is what's worrying Kissinger. He thinks the whole Mediterranean now is going to go communist. So we're going to go into war to prevent this? Oh, I mean, it's sick.
Well, let me go.
Yeah. Now,
when did you find a publisher for your book?
I found a publisher instantly because the first book, I'm a current history, an editor, and I used to write a good deal for them, and that's who called me up one Monday and wants me to write about Spain today, what's going to happen in Spain, and I said it would take too much time, I don't do it. So the people at Current History said to me in 1960, I just mentioned I had this book, I had many books, I have a whole lot of books, the half written and almost wholly written, you see, and they said, have you ever given it, asked Peter Ritten? And I says, I never heard of him. Who was he? Call him up, Hat McMillan. So I'm right to the phone. I was at the American Historical Association in New York, the meeting of 1960, and I went to the phone and called McMillan and asked for Peter Ritner, and he came on, and I said, I have a book, and I have somebody here who's the editor of Current History who says that you would like it, and so forth. He says, send it to me. A week later, I got a letter from him. It's a marvelous book.
How many pages did you send
him? I sent him the whole thing.
Which was
just about that fat. It came out as a book of 279 printed pages, so it wasn't very long, you see. He accepted it within a week.
Which book is this now?
This is the first book.
Okay, right. Okay.
This is 1961. You'll find all of this in Who's Who, you see, the dates.
Yes.
You see. All right. That's how I got my first book published. Now, when I signed the contract for that, 1961, they made me agree that I would give them my next book.
Sure.
You see? So in a couple of years, I said to Peter Ritten, I want the next book to be The World Since 1914. And he said, okay, let's sign a contract.
He didn't say anything like, that's a rather large subject, Carol?
Peter Ritten thinks I am the greatest writer around.
Okay, is he an editor?
He's gone, left him. Okay. You see, now here's what happened, and I don't know whether we want to get this on tape, but I'll put it on tape, but look, you've got to be discreet.
Sure.
You know, you have to protect my future.
Sure.
As well as your own.
Sure.
All right. When Tragedy and Hope was signed, the contract, and right up to the last minute, which would be the spring and summer of 66.
Now, you are going to hear what Dr. Quigley wanted him to be discreet with. He's a little concerned. He doesn't want to get this information out too far. He doesn't want to get anybody angry with him, but he's going to give the reporter the background. This was actually a tape that was made by the reporter who was interviewing Quigley about the book, Tragedy and Hope, the single most important book dealing with the geopolitical situation that is available in the world today. Let's go on.
They were planning to bring it out in two volumes, boxed, for $17.50. Mm-hmm.
Macmillan had been bought by from Harold Macmillan, that's the Macmillan Company of England, mm-hmm. for $5 million, because he needed the cash. In the summer of 66, a holding company, Collier Books, which originally was Morgan, and they published Collier's Magazine. Remember Collier's Weekly and so forth? All right. Collier's Books, now I don't know who controls it now, and it's one of these holding companies, mm-hmm. came in. They bought up the Free Press, you know, in Illinois. They bought up Brentano bookstores. Mm-hmm. They bought up Macmillan. They came in and they looked at what they'd bought and they said, you're spending money wild and you're not taking in money. We got to stop it.
The accountants took over.
Yeah. So they said, no advertising on any books that are published for the next 6 months. You spent too much on advertising. And the editors like Peter Rittner screamed and said, we're not going to stay if this is the way you're going to do things. So they said, all right, one ad for each book. All right, I got one ad for Tragedy and Hope. And it was a quarter page in the New York Times book review, I believe. That's all.
How do you spell Rittner's name?
R-I-T-N-E-R. Okay. Peter Rittner. I imagine he's in Who's Who. He should be. Anyway, he has since left them. I don't know what he is doing. He still lives in the same place that I visited him in Riverside Drive up near the George Washington Bridge. Mm. But he works for some world book thing.
A world publisher.
Something else. And what he does, I don't know, because he's never cut in touch with me since he left.
And but they also did not come out with the two lines. Right?
No. So then when they saw it, they said, oh, this is going to cost too much. Cut it to one volume and cut the price $5. So that made it $12.50, but they never sold it at $12.50. They made it $12.95, so this is what it was sold. Now, it went out of print. That was 66. It went out of print in 68. But in 68, Collier Books got in touch with me, I don't know how or why, and said, we'll bring out the last half of this as a paperback, and that's what I gave you. That came out in 68.
Right.
And that, I think, is still in print. But I can't get an answer. I can't get a straight answer to any question from them. For example, they never told me until 1974, when I was trying to fight the pirate who reprinted Tragedy and Hope,
right.
that it had been out of print. They told me it's out of stock, and we will republish when we get 2,000.
Right.
But they never could get 2,000. I've told you this, haven't I? Mm-hmm. Because they were telling everybody who wrote in that it's out of print.
Now,
and they denied to me.
When did you realize there was a pirate edition? How did you find out?
I found out when somebody got a plain envelope with a slip of paper in it, available again, in short supply, Tragedy and Hope.
The whole book.
The whole book.
Let me give you a little of the background of what had happened. Macmillan had distributed a few thousand copies, perhaps 8,000 copies, of this most important book. And then suddenly it wasn't available anymore. You couldn't buy it any place in the country. And so there is a publishing house in Southern California, in Hollywood, called Angriff Press. And they publish suppressed books. In other words, those books which have been actively censored by the establishment. And so they began putting the book out and actually selling. If you looked at the book, you couldn't tell that it wasn't one of the original copies. There was no way it was identical to the original copies, all done in photo offset. And much of what you're going to hear about is Professor Quigley talking about the pirate who stole his book. Now, of course, the pirate wanted to get this information out because this information is vital to the survival of our society. The pirate didn't put the book out because he wanted necessarily to make money, but what Professor Quigley had uncovered was so vitally important. The pirate Angriff Press wanted the public, at least those of us who are interested in the survival of our society, to be able to have access to it. So let's go on now with Professor Quigley.
And
they came to you and said,
they called me up and said, did you know that your book is reprinted? I said, which book? Because they both had a print, see? And they said, Tragedy and Hope. I said, no, it isn't.
You don't know who this person was?
No, because it's exact copy, exact. The dust jacket, everything, the binding is the same.
Did they reset the type, or is it just
photo reproduction? Okay. It's exactly the same.
Okay.
Now, I can tell instantly that it's different because they didn't notice that the original had yellow top on the pages here.
All right.
You see, the original, right. The new one is white.
So you, I would imagine, would call Macmillan and say, hey, you must be upset that they're reprinting this. I mean, that would be a logical reaction.
They didn't give a damn, and I'll tell you why.
But did you call... Now, how much is... Well, we'll talk when we're done with it, and I'll ask you how much of this you're comfortable with in light of your lawsuit, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, okay. I don't
well,
know.
We can talk about that.
And I don't know why McMillan acted like this. Now, immediately...
But my logical reaction would be to call McMillan and say, gee, you must really be upset.
No, I didn't. Not right away, I didn't, because they had lied to me so many times and so many
issues.
So you
already knew it was unpleasant.
There's something funny. They had lied and lied and lied and lied to me, you see. On everything, and I have letters to prove that, because I have from Rittner letters apologizing for information he previously given to him, because they had lied to him when he called up to ask
right.
if they're out of print or not, you see, and they said no and so forth. Now, oh, the big thing is my contract both had in it that if it went out of print, I had the right to recover the plates.
Right.
They never got in touch with me off of the plates. I learned in March of this year that they destroyed the plates of Tragedy and Hope.
Did you get that? They destroyed the plates of Tragedy and Hope. Why did they destroy it? People were writing from all over the country to get copies of it. You heard the professor saying that. People could keep saying, we want to get copies of it. They were writing to Professor Quigley to get copies of it. And then the publisher said, oh, well, there's just no copies available because we don't have enough orders. And, of course, they wouldn't take orders, they wouldn't republish it, and then somebody destroyed the plates. Let's go on now with Professor Quigley's story of what happened to his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, the single most important book giving you the background of the secret societies in the world today.
I learned in the summer 1971, because my wife got mad and called Macmillan on the phone every week while I was in England, and finally got from them a letter in which they said the plates had been destroyed. They had inadvertently destroyed the plates of the first book.
Yeah.
Civilizations, you see?
Okay. So you find, yeah. So a guy yeah. calls you, an anonymous caller.
Yeah,
so,
well, he identified himself to me, but he's no. Okay. And he gave me his name and so forth, and he had got this. And you want to shut that off for a second?
Sure.
And the way I found out was, I sent an order. I let somebody else send an order. Now, this was my assistant who sent a check, sent an order, and nothing came. And then we discovered they'd only pay if you sent them cash ahead of time. You see?
A check wouldn't do?
Well, I guess I did send a check. That
but not,
was
not,
it.
Not the whole.
No, I sent the check, the whole thing. But they, for example, will not send to bookstores unless they send cash, and they're all suspicious. Because if you order 10 copies, and that would be $120, because he was asking $12, you could vanish, because there's no way to find out who it is.
Sure.
You have no name. You have a box number in California and so forth. And anyway, I couldn't find out anything. I got it back, and I was shocked because it was identical, you see, or almost identical. So then I got other companies were offering it.
When is it?
This was in this year.
This year?
Yes, January.
January this year.
1974.
Okay.
This year. By March, somebody came to me and had one of the pirate copies. I said, where'd you get it? And they said, Sidney Kramer. I said, does he have it? And they said, sure, he had four or five of them there. So I called up Sidney Kramer and asked if he had it, and he said, yes, and I went down there. And he's very hard to get information out of, but finally I found out that he sent an order in, and they send me a check, and I'll send it, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And he sold them and repeated the order and so forth. So then I told our bookstore.
He's using the same address you have?
Yes, he was
you
using
still don't know who it is. And I mean, at that time, you did not know who it is.
I still am not certain.
Really?
Who it is. And I will now, and I'll tell you why. One of the places that was offering them for sale, and there was about five places that were offering it for sale, and I've got since a number of others, that they come to me from students, or they don't come right to me directly ever. Now, no one ever approached me. Well, one reason I was suspicious of Macmillan was this. The fact that the radical right, the John Birch Society and so forth, was getting all up over this book goes back to at least 69.
I was going to ask you about that.
69. Yes, and a book appeared called The Naked Capitalist by Skousens. Now, of this book, about a fifth of it is direct quote from my book. Now, he says it's from my book, it's in quotation marks, but nevertheless, it's a violation of copyright. I got in touch with Macmillan, they would not do a thing.
McMillan didn't want to call attention to this. The last thing McMillan would want would be a trial, and the facts would be brought out that there was a secret society, and the people who owned McMillan were part of it, at least a covert organization to take over control of the publishing and the banking and the media in America. And all of these things are covered in the book, even how the Great Foundation work in concert to influence our society and actually to finance both the right and the left. Nobody would want to bring that out in a court. Little wonder McMillan didn't want to go after Cleon Skousen, former police chief of Salt Lake City, a very, very excellent conservative writer who had written a book called The Naked Capitalist, quoting extensively from Carol Quigley's book and Carol Quigley's story of those organizations working within the shadows to influence both political parties and make mockery out of the concepts of democracy in the world today. And with that, back to Carol Quigley, mentor, teacher, and the man who was to shape the thought processes and policies of the man who would one day become the President of the United States, William Clinton.
They said, I said, aren't you going to defend my copyright? They said, no, if you want to do something, we will support you and, you know, and be a witness if you want and so forth. Well, I wasn't going to sue this guy. He's a professor of religion at Brigham Young University, former police chief of Salt Lake City, you know,
about him.
All right.
He's run the gamut.
So whether he has, yeah, and he'd been in the FBI for years.
Right.
So whether he would have any money, it wouldn't be worth my while to sue him, you see, probably. And another state and so forth. So I decided I'd let that go, but then I discovered they wouldn't do anything. And then Congressman Rarick, who was beaten in the primary just now, put that book into the congressional record, and a lot of things like this. Then this book was distributed to every registered voter in New Hampshire.
At no point, they never called you and said, and asked for a quote. I mean,
no, nobody ever.
It'd be like me writing a story without ever talking to you.
Yeah, nobody ever wrote to me about this.
Hmm? Do you know where they got the picture of you, from the PR office here?
I think, let me see which picture it is. They tried to get pictures from the PR office, and I said, don't give anybody a picture if they won't tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they got this from the PR office. Mm-hmm. Now, Skousen couldn't get a picture of me. Mm-hmm. You see, they could have got a picture off the back of the, there's a full picture of me, on the back of the jacket of the first book, mm-hmm. from Backrack, mm-hmm. here in town. But you know, that's the one they have in the public relations office here now, still. It's the only one there is, and that's where they got that. Well, it's all right, but then they put it on the same page with J.P. Morgan. You know, this is a nonsense to me. Yeah, I mean, you're right to laugh. It's a joke, but it's also silly, linking me with Morgan or with any of these people. And now there's others that are...
You don't know Gary Allen personally.
No. Now, here's what happened. A crisis occurred at Brigham Young, and I should not go into it in detail because I don't know anything for sure.
Yeah, I know something.
All right, they had a hell of a... The campus was blown apart by a fight between the political science department and Skousen's, in which they declared he was unworthy to be a Mormon professor and should be fired.
Right.
And he defended himself, and what happened, I do not know. All I know is this.
He lost.
Who?
He lost.
Oh, did he?
He got ousted.
Oh, I didn't know that. You see, I never find out. Nobody ever tells me these things.
I'll check. Former chief of police felt like they actually had quite weird adjusts to their trainings.
That's what happens to professors in some schools when they begin talking about the establishment. They simply get fired. But Carol Quigley, Georgetown, nobody ever challenged him on what he'd written. After all, he was one of the leaders there, certainly one of the more brilliant professors. And I suppose that back in Washington, D.C., where Georgetown is, they didn't want to create an issue talking about America's invisible government.
He did get rid of him, huh?
He did. I think he lost that fight in the university option. I know where to go.
Well, anyway, the reason, all I know about it is this. I gave three papers at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I'm going to give you one of them.
Okay.
And because they liked it so much, they printed thousands of them, or, you know, processed thousands of them and distributed them to all the press in the press room.
Right.
They liked this one, so it wasn't the best of them. Mm-hmm. General Crises and Civilization, you know, which this is an attractive title. Now, somebody called me up and wanted to talk to me at this. And I think it was at this. And he said his name was Larson, and he was a scientist from Brigham Young, And he wanted to see and talk to me because of what was going on up there. I says, what is going on up there? Oh, he says they have mass meetings on this. And he says, it's just an uproar all the time. Well, I didn't know. Now, he made an interview with me. And he wanted to play it on the campus radio or the local radio station. And I said, all right.
What was the interview about?
About.
Just about this paper?
Yeah. No, about the Skousen's controversy.
Okay.
And I said, all right, let me know what happens. But he never wrote to me. I never found out. Mm. I never made any effort. So I don't know whether it was ever broadcast or not.
What was your input in that? What did you have to say about the Skousen's controversy?
Well, I simply told him that Skousen's wrote this book. He never
talked to me
about it. He violated my copyright. It's full of lies and things that are untrue. It takes things out of context and misinterprets them. And I gave him the specific things where I disagree. The group that I'm writing about was originally, in my mind, the group established secretly by Lord Milner in 1908 and 1909 called the Round Table Group, which still publishes a quarterly magazine called the Round Table in London, which is one of the world's best sources of international relations information since 1910.
The secret society he was writing about was the one founded by Lord Milner about in the early 1900s. And still publishes a publication, and you can get that at the university library here. And if you read it, you will find how the at least up until the early 1980s, how the one theme recurrent in these magazines is that their goal and objective was to bring the kingdom of heaven to earth. That's what they were going to do. They were going to create a world utopia, just exactly as Plato had dreamed of. But Carol Quigley is talking about the Round Table, which was the secret society. Of course, it really was an outgrowth of the secret societies created by Cecil Rhodes in the 19th century. And, of course, that then became the Royal Institute for International Affairs in England, the Canadian Institute in Canada, the South African Institute in South Africa, and similar institutes in all of the Commonwealth countries. But in America, it became the Council on Foreign Relations.
The first editor of it was Lord Lothian, at that time Philip Carr, K-E-R-R. And nobody knew this, really, for years. I got to know things. And I investigated that group, you see? Mm-hmm. Now, how I found it is very interesting. I noticed that prominent people in English life had Fellow of All Souls College. Lord Halifax, who was the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, and then they made him ambassador to America. When they take the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs and makes him ambassador to Washington, which most people would consider a downward step, it shows how important they considered Washington's support would be in World War II, you see? Mm-hmm. All right, he's a Fellow of All Souls. The fellow who summoned Neville Chamberlain in the 10th of May, 1940, and said, for God's sake, go, was Leo Amery. All right, he was a sidekick, the chief lieutenant, political lieutenant of Lord Milner. You see, he was a Fellow of All Souls. And so I decided I would study all souls. This is purely historical.
Right.
I got the names of all the people who had been Fellows of All Souls since 1899 to whenever I was doing it, which would be about 1947. And there were 149 of them. I discovered most of them were fellows for only 7 years, which is the regular appointment. It's for 7 years. But some of them were for 55 years, Fellows of All Souls. A man named Dougal Malcolm, who was the head of the British South Africa Company, which is what Rhodesia, you see. And he was for 55 years. I discovered that Lord Brand, who had been with Milner in South Africa, was for years. And he was the head of Lazar Brothers Bankers in London. And I discovered that Leo Amery was for years and so forth. And above all, I discovered a man named Lionel Curtis who had no right whatever to be a Fellow of All Souls. You get to be a Fellow of All Souls either because you are a very prominent person and as an honorary thing you will become an honorary fellow for 7 years, or because you are an outstanding scholar and you get it by competitive examination when you graduate. That's how Lord Halifax got it. His name was Charles Wood in 1903 when he graduated from Oxford. He took a competitive examination and got it. But he's kept it. Now, I discovered he kept it because he went immediately to South Africa and met the kindergarten, which was the group of people that were running South Africa for Lord Milner, you see. They were called kindergarten because they were all young kids, mm-hmm. you see. Now, these are the ones who remained forever after, fellows of all sorts, or in Lionel Curtis's case, he's the man who said, we've got to change the name from British Empire to Commonwealth of Nations. And the reason is they had been students of Alfred Zimmern, who wrote a book in 1909 called The Greek Commonwealth, describing ancient Greece, you see? Mm-hmm. And who was the man who made Arnold Toynbee a great classical scholar, do you see? And brought him into international affairs. Now, I knew none of this. Mm-hmm. All I knew is that here was a fellow, Lionel Curtis, who was such a poor student, it took him 15 years to get his degree, and then he got it about the lowest pass degree or something that you could ever get.
Mm-hmm. And here he was.
And nobody knew it. Nobody had ever heard of him.
Right. But he was in an extraordinary company.
I later discovered, furthermore, he was Lord Halifax's roommate at All Souls for years. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered this fella is behind everything that's going on. Lionel Curtis, you see? Now, I don't think we should talk too much about this.
Well, no, I...
You see? All right. But having discovered that, I met Alfred Zimmern. He came here to give a speech. And I said, isn't it funny that the All Souls... He said, that's the Roundtable Group. I had never heard of them. That shows how little I knew of. They'd been around since 1909 and published this magazine since 1910, and this was 1947. Mm-hmm. And I said, what does the Roundtable Group... He named them, who they were. And he says, I was a member of them. For 10 years, from 1913, and they brought me in and invited me because I was in the Workers Educational Alliance. This was extension programs, night courses, summer courses for workers, Workers Educational Alliance. And he said, that's why they brought me into it, and I was for 10 years, and he says, I resigned in 1923 because they were determined to build up Germany against France. He says, I wouldn't stand for it, so I resigned. Now, when I met Lord Brand later and asked him about this, he had never seen the letter of resignation. Now, so I better stop talking because, you see, this gets into all kinds of things. Now, this is, I knew the Roundtable Group was very influential. I knew that they were the real founders of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and I knew they were the, all the stuff that's in print, that they were the real founders of the Institute of Pacific Relations. I knew that they were the godfathers of the... Council on Foreign Relations here.
For those of you who don't know, the Institute of Pacific Relations was found to be a communist front by the McCarran Committee, four decades ago. Very, very embarrassing for the establishment to be exposed for actively working to bring communism to China. But that's another story entirely. But the Institute, if you go up and you read the copies of the Roundtable magazine at the university, they list all the organizations affiliated with them. It's either the Roundtable or the Royal Institute International Affairs, either the Roundtable magazine or the older issues of the International Affairs, and they list all of their organizations, including the Institute of Pacific Relations. And of course, as he said, and this then became the godfather of the Council on Foreign Relations, of which Bill Clinton, Ross Perot and George Bush were all proud members.
I knew that, for example, you know the big study of history, many volumes of Arnold Toynbee? Mm-hmm. All right. I knew the manuscripts of that were stored in the Council on Foreign Relations during the war so they wouldn't be destroyed by German bombing, do you see? Mm-hmm. And so forth. And so forth. So I began to put these things together and discovered that this group was working for the following things. They were a secret group. They were working to federate the English-speaking world, mm-hmm. the English-speaking world. Mm-hmm. They were closely linked to international bankers. They were working to establish a world, what I call a three-power world. And that three-power world was the Atlantic bloc of England and the Commonwealth and the United States, Germany, Hitler's Germany, Soviet Russia, the three-power world. They said, Germany we can control because it's boxed in, and all of this is in my book, it's boxed in between the Atlantic bloc and the Russians. The Russians will behave because they're boxed in between the Atlantic bloc, the American Navy, and Singapore, and so forth, and the Germans, do you see?
Right.
And therefore, now this is all described in my book, and this was their idea. Now notice, it's a balance of power system. Mm. It's essentially what Kissinger, although he doesn't know what he's doing, he's bungling everything. Because he's just a prima donna, you know, emotionally unbalanced person. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing, but it was a good idea. And what he should have been doing is described by me, and you really should read this, in Current History for October 1968. Now, if I had a copy, I'd give it to you, but I don't have it. It is how to construct a multi-block world in which the United States would be secure as we ever can be, and be independent and have freedom of action. Do you see? But he's blowing it in one way and another. And the whole thing's going to explode in his face, I'm afraid. And I hope to God it doesn't, because we can't afford, you know, another mess like this, these incompetents. Now, what is said in here is that these people are for world domination.
And that you are-
and the group I'm talking about were not. Mm-hmm. They were largely, partly financed, for instance, by the by Rhodes, the Rhodes Trust. And the, how Milner got into this was he was the chief Rhodes trustee. Mm-hmm. From 1905, when he came back from Africa, to his death in 1925. All right. Okay. So this was a, it's an Atlantic block. It, this, you know, Strite, Clarence Strite, S-T-R-E-I-T, Union Now, Union Now with Great Britain. All right. He represents what this group wanted. Clarence, S-T-R-E-I-T. If he's still alive, he probably lives in Washington. I had his daughter in my class, and as a visitor, but not as a student of mine. And he was built up by this people as the only solution. This is in my book. His name and when it happened. And
by the Roundtable people.
By the Roundtable people. And it was his book, Union Now, which came out in 1938, was called anonymously in the Roundtable magazine by Lionel Curtis, The Only Way, it was headed. It was then reviewed anonymously in the Christian Science Monitor by Lord Lothian as the solution of our problems. And what it is essentially a union of the Atlantic bloc.
Not this, world domination.
Not world domination. And of course, this was Rhodes' idea.
Right.
He wanted the United States in the English Commonwealth. All right. Secondly, these people are not pro-communists, as I know them. And certainly the Roundtable group and the Milner group and the people that I'm writing about, and I notice I followed them up only to 1940, mm-hmm. which is the end of the Morgan Bank, when they had to incorporate because of the inheritance taxes and so forth. They had to incorporate. They were before that a partnership. Where you, they,
when did the Council on Foreign Relations form?
It was originally established by a group here about 1919. But they had, in the group that we went, is the Inquiry. The Inquiry was the post-war planning group set up by the Morgan interests in 1917 in the United States, of which the technical head was the head of the American Geographical Society. All of this is in my book. No.
Oh, you're
that's National Geographic.
I have that on my mind.
Elihu, was it? No.
That's
a, well, it doesn't. It's in my book. You see, my names are slipping me now. Anyway, it's called The Inquiry. There's a whole book on it, and it's called The Inquiry, so you can find it by looking up that title. Mm-hmm. But you can find it also, if you can look in my book. The unfortunate part is it's not in the paperback. It's naturally, it's in the first part when they were forming the thing, which is in the big version of it. The Inquiry got together in Paris and agreed to establish an organization out of which came the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And that Royal Institute of International Affairs had branches in all of the Commonwealth countries, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Canada, eventually in India, and they even, I think, had one somewhere else, Pakistan, when it divided, they established one. But in the United States, of course, they didn't have to because they had the Council on Foreign Relations. But when they came over here, coming back from Paris, they found that a movement had begun here already to form a Council on Foreign Relations, so they moved in and took it over, and they could do that because they represented Morgan. Mm-hmm. And in that crowd was Willard Strait, who was a Morgan partner, and he died at the peace conference of the influenza, and of course the man who was the active supposed to be, Lamont, Tom Lamont.
Well, I think that you've heard the majority of what needs to be heard. You probably know more history now than most people do, and you heard it from the man who taught Bill Clinton, and the man that Bill Clinton attributed his attitude towards the world to, Carol Quigley. You've heard the story of his book, how it was suppressed, and basically what it covered, this idea of uniting the United States to Great Britain. Of course, the ideas have evolved since the time when Carol Quigley wrote his book, and of course, the idea of uniting the United States to Europe has altered. And now the plan, as laid out in Foreign Affairs magazine, is to create a United States of North America, a United States of Europe, probably one more major bloc involving the nations of Southeast Asia, the Pacific Rim, and then after you have the three separate major power blocs, eventually to merge them all into what George Bush so cleverly or so fondly refers to as the New World Order. The ideas come out of Foreign Affairs magazine. It's been written, it's part of the plan, and Foreign Affairs, of course, is the publication of the invisible government of the United States. Now, we're going to put our lines open, 464-8295. If any of you would like to call, we have just a few minutes left. That's 464-8295. And if you don't call in, we're going to have to hear me talking for the few minutes that we have left, and reminding you that this is Radio Liberty at 89.9 FM on your radio dial. KFER coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful Monterey Bay. And that if you would like copies of any of the tapes that we have, we provide them on a regular basis for the supporters of the program, whether it's the interview with the colonel that we had last night, with Don Francis, the world's leading epidemiologist, and really one of the more exciting interviews from my point of view. Oh, let's see, we have Tony on line one here. Tony,
yeah, thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions.
Okay, fine.
One was, you referred to Franklin Roosevelt as being a 33rd degree level Mason.
Yes, he was.
If my understanding is right, the 33rd degree is something that is very sinister.
Well, it's the highest degree. You don't earn that. You have to be specially appointed to it. You have to be... by the time you get to the 33rd degree, you're told the final secrets of Masonry. And the thing is that most Masons are good, wonderful, patriotic people who have no idea what Masonry is all about. And one of these evenings, if you'd like, I'm sure if Bill is listening, he'll want to talk about Masonry, and we will take you into the true meaning of Masonry on the writings of Albert Pike and of Manly Hall. And Manly Hall was an occultist who lived in Southern California, 33rd degree Mason, who wrote extensively on the secrets of Masonry and how it all begins to tie together. But if you listen on Monday, when we're going to have Tal Brooks, who's an ex-Indian mystic, got into Hinduism, worshipped to the feet of the gurus, and then begin to understand the occult movement, the New Age movement, and he'll begin, at least will help you to begin to tie in the Masonry with the New Age, with the Theosophists, with this whole occultic movement towards a New World Order. Tal Brooks' book, When the World Will Be One. And I think you'll find it a fascinating evening.
Oh, and one other thing. Now, I've been sort of stumbled across information on the International Monetary Fund.
All right.
And I seem to remember reading that Leon Panetta was deeply involved in this, and it really ties into the Federal Reserve and the CFR. Do you have any comment about that?
Well, the International Monetary Fund was organized at Bretton Woods in 1944 to 1945, and it was to be the stabilizing international financial force after the Second World War. It was formed initially under the auspices and under the direction of Harry Dexter White, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and also a communist spy. Now, please don't think I'm suggesting the CFR is a communist organization, for as Professor Quigley said, the CFR is not a communist organization. It is not pro-communist. And that's entirely true. It's just not pro-American. It has its own goals and objectives, and these people could care less about the future of America Their dream is of an internationalist dream. But Harry Dexter White had very cleverly infiltrated the CFR and, as a communist spy, was using the power and influence of the council to further the one-world goals of the world communist movement. Anybody who wants to read the background of Harry Dexter White, there's a great deal written about him. Actually, the day before he was to testify before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, he suddenly had a heart attack and died. And that's what happens often. But the IMF is a very powerful organization controlling world finance.